Welcome to The Better Build, a podcast that explores the world of software engineering leadership and the people who are shaping it. Let's get to the episode.
Welcome to the podcast, The Better Build, where we explore the world of software engineering leadership and the people who are shaping it. I'm Gabriel, one of the co-founders of Mission, and today I'm going to be your host. Today we have Yevgen Reztov. Yev is a multiple-time founder currently working on his latest stealth startup that hopefully he'll tell us a little bit about if he can. Yev's worked as a staff engineer at Walmart Intuit and has been helping build software for close to two decades now. He's been working on DevOps, data engineering, data science way before all of the recent craze in the last 2 years related to data. Looking forward to the conversation. Yev, thanks for making the time to join us today.
Sure, Gabriel. Yep. Long story short, I've been working with data science, data engineering, machine learning for 15 years now in a fairly almost full-time capacity. Hopefully, some of the insights I can provide on both the human and technical front are useful for you guys. And Gabriel, thanks for having me.
Can you talk a little bit about the companies that you started, the journey of going from an engineer to more of an entrepreneur?
Yeah, sure thing. To kick that background off, I moved to the US when I was in my teens. And I'm in a bit of a weird situation. My father and then my grandmother, which was very difficult back then, were also computer scientists. Back in the 50s, 60s.
In the 50s.
Being a female computer scientist was very difficult. And then I've been exposed to it since I was like six, and I love it. That's my problem. I actually love it. When work ends, my idea of a hobby project is go build software for a drone or go build software. So I'm biased in that sense. My first job when I started working here in the US at the age of 18 was with a company called Arrowhead General Insurance. They're an amazing company. Very long term, very low turnover, very high average tenure. People stay there for decades, even to this day, which is very uncommon for a tech company. But unfortunately, I found out my team was great. Everything was great, but just the pace was too slow. I felt bored. I would finish a week's work and maybe a day, but literally just, what am I doing? And my initial impetus was to essentially put myself to the test by making a direct correlation, because at most companies, I feel like obviously what people get compensated and the actual value they produce, especially with economies of scale, the very big gap there. Like, for example, Blizzard, before Activision bought them, was notorious for this. They had the highest revenue per employee of all the companies in the US for a little bit. They were making like $1.5 to $3 million per employee. And I was looking at stuff like that. And I was like, it's because for people, it depends. Like, what do you want out of work? Do you just want it to serve a purpose, be very well balanced? If you have a family, you have young kids, those folks don't want what I want. The purpose work serves is different. For me, it's also my hobby. So I just, salary work was a poor fit for me. Because I would be sit there, be producing more and more value, and it's not reflected in the compensation I get, essentially. So I started my first company before I was 20. First, it was a consulting company. Then we started a couple of our own projects, and that one thing led to another, and we were acquired by a Fortune 500 company when I was 23, I think. And I learned some unfortunate lessons in that, mainly that if you take investment or VC money, your company might get sold without your say-so. For example, that was a weird one. And after that, disillusioned me for a little bit. That's when I went back to salaried work, to Intuit, Walmart. And most importantly, I realized during that short test run, in hindsight, I realized that I'm lacking a lot of things. I'm lacking management skills. I don't know what are good processes for a company. So I went there to learn and observe, like, how does a scaled brand organization look like? And then I observed, like, literally every day, I would take notes to learn the internal process because it interested me. And I found that there are some common gaps in the process too. That's very arrogant of me to say, right? But from my perspective, I thought at the time that I could do things better. And obviously, it's just like, you can't run a company of five the same way you run a company of 5 million people. But at least in a small scale, I took a lot of inspiration from the large scale processes, and that was fun. And now I started two companies recently. They're both doing quite well. We choose to basically stay out of public spotlight because so defensibility comes to play. You have defensibility of an idea, defensibility of a team, and machine learning, unfortunately, is a very dog-eat-dog world. Because even if you have great team executing excellence, it's a defensible idea. The only true defensibility in machine learning currently is building a unique data set that nobody else has that enables you capabilities that nobody else does. Because anything we do, I think anything companies with a market cap of I think it's safe to say less than, if your market cap is 8 digits, under 100 million, you run the very real risk of a big company just rolling out a single product or feature that destroys your business. Because machine learning is still a very walled garden. There's a big disparity. If a company can afford to purchase, organize, and structure a massive amount of data, they will build the product you spent 3 years building in 3 months better than you.
Just because they have the capacity to be able to. And once they observe an insight that you've identified, it's easy in some ways to throw money at it.
Yes and no. I feel like it's almost like some kind of strange multiplier function. How much data you have, how much compute budget you have, multiplied by essentially how good are your engineers. That's a big one. It's a very underestimated one. The problem is those companies also have the best talent because they have the best benefits. So it's, yeah, deep pockets is a factor, but it's a very much a walled garden. A lot of the best machine learning engineers I know, they're getting paid at least 750 grand at a very big company. So it's a walled garden of, to your point, of deep pockets, economies of scale. They have the best people that they can acquire the best data. And the most difficult part about that is when you have an insane amount of resources in your internal employee resource pool, they can allocate a very senior data science team of two pizza-sized teams and organize an immense amount of data, very well structured, within weeks. That's something that takes a startup like almost a quarter or multiple quarters. And it's just economies of scale, unfortunately, translate to almost tiers of quality in machine learning, especially because, and let's tie back to this later, but a lot of our customers that are like, we want machine learning, the reality that we have to ease them into is if you don't have some kind of basic data science team, you almost have no use for AI at all. And that's a reality that a lot of companies don't like to hear because everybody's, we could use Copilot or ChatGPT Enterprise, which is absolutely true, they could. But if that's what they want to do, we're not the partner for it. Actually, what it comes down to.
Last time we spoke, you talked about how data teams or engineering teams can be smart about how they run their research and how to set up machine learning properly so that, like you alluded to, you're not burning a lot of money. Can you share some just high-level perspectives or direction for our listeners in terms of what are some of the things to look out for to make sure that you're not wasting money?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one thing that I consistently find if we go into an org, so companies that are tech companies, even they sometimes we see severely misguided attempts. And what it comes down to is, let's take this back to, and so AI is new, but it's also very old. In some ways, let's take it back to the days of like when people were transitioning from hardware data centers to the cloud. Docker popped up, all the orchestration tools for it popped up. Kubernetes became obviously the big winner there. And we had service meshes like Istio, we had load balancers, Nginx, Envoy. And all of those, back when that was coming together, it was a very volatile, rapid changing field, just like it is now. But at the end of the day, any architecture that could, first of all, that actually existed, could support rapid switching out of components and a very high level top down structure, generally one. You had, back in the days of Kubernetes, you had your ingress, egress, your scaling groups, your load balancers, the service meshes, and a lot of mistakes were being made. And especially for the big companies, they were expensive mistakes, but it was a learning effort. And I think in machine learning, especially, almost the same thing is happening. There's an over-focus on LLMs. There's many types of machine learning. And I think it helps most teams to treat different types of machine learning, different constructs, different ways of training, exactly like they do platform infrastructure components. Yeah. For example, certain types of machine learning might be treated as a service mesh or a load balancer or some other component, right? Like maybe a Redis cache, and then you get down to, for example, what kind of cache is that least recently used? Do you cache up to memory? There's different characteristics. What's missing for most teams trying to do machine learning is, one, they don't think about the overall architecture. Two, they don't know the pros and cons of even, let's use an example our readers are familiar with, like different foundational models. They don't know the pros and cons of each specific model. Because for example, if you're doing search retrieval, we found Gemini to be one of the best ones because it provides citations, which are very useful when you're doing a search in internal documents. Now, if you're doing something like trying to create meeting summaries or legal briefs, we found Opus to be very superior. from Anthropic. And for the rest of it, like if you're just doing general purpose interaction, ChatGPT is usually okay. Those are very subtle differences, but if you try to fit square pegs into round holes and you try to use any one of those models for everything, you get subpar result, and that's not a big effort. It's just a matter of understanding the market, understanding what's out there, understanding what performs better for what. And most teams don't even make those considerations. And what it comes down to is, so there's a process called ADRs that was introduced by Apache and Oracle, I believe. They're called architectural decision records. And the requirement is for evaluating any vendor or any kind of big tech decision, you should have at least three choices. You should write down pros and cons, have a meeting with your engineers, make a team decision. Right now in AI, that's not being done because people don't even know what to put in the pros and cons columns. That's how fresh it is. And I feel like if I was to share anything with teams, one, treat your data as the code contract for your models. Your data is almost the interface for your models, for most of them. And that's, I feel like that's really not appreciated enough. And after that, evaluate what's out there. Have pros and cons, make a conscious design choice as to why you're using that thing. And number three is wrap everything. Doesn't matter if it's a tiny embedding. It doesn't matter if it's like a very simple retrieval augmented generation. Wrap that in interfaces so you can switch your underlying models and your underlying vendors. That is number one. Because once something goes wrong, once the system starts misperforming, we find that because it's so fresh and it's the Wild West and most companies try to do this thing, they don't have a platform or a data science team to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah. I think as you alluded to before, there are a limited number of people in the ecosystem in the US and even globally that have experience, like practical experience doing these things. I think a lot of people, even there might be folks that are coming more out of the research side, have experience in terms of the theories and whatnot, but they don't have the practical experience. And so for a lot of people, it's trial and error. I'm curious whether you feel that folks that are coming more out of an enterprise world are better suited, or it's more natural for them to think about things through this lens of properly planning, and whether or interested to folks that are coming more out of the startup world where we had the benefit of everything being very throwaway and cheap and fast to build and deploy. And so there was never this idea of really planning. You would just be very agile, create a lot of waste. It was okay because there was not much of a cost to that waste in some ways.
I think it depends on the type of problem that the company is trying to solve. Generally, I think there are two overarching types of ML systems. There is, I would say that the simplest way I could put this is, depending on what data you're working with, quantitative and qualitative, and what the structure of that data is, a lot of the time, there's almost like a learning rate multiplier that you can optimize the system for. And a lot of companies, they don't, if they're not working on LLMs, which it's the hype, but it's such a small part of actual machine learning, right? At the end of the day, you have supervised learning, you have unsupervised learning, semi-supervised reinforcements, regression vector machines, decision trees. I'm not going to go into all of that for our audience, but the data set you're working with is very, just that's the reality of it. Sometimes you have to create your data set, especially if you're solving unique defensible problems. Your data set is limited. And in those instances, I would say people that are used to working with like terabytes and exabytes of data are almost completely useless. It's just like a normal engineer. If you bring an engineer from any fan company, they will over-engineer everything. And at the end of the day, you just need to push a product or a feature to your customer. Not all of them, but some of them. That tends to be the trend. And I think there's a very similar fit. If you need a system with a very high learning rate that might overshoot, that might have some accuracy bias issues that iron out later after you ship to the customer, I really think that's a big difference. And to answer your question, depends on the nature of the work. If there's a big data set available and a company is basically trying to fine tune it, format it, organize it, then there's definitely a massive advantage to having more when big scale situations. If not, then not. I feel like it's very similar to traditional companies. If you need a system that is very data heavy, that runs at scale, the only people that can build that are people that have seen systems that run scale. But reality is most companies don't.
Makes sense. I think last time we spoke, you mentioned something about how to measure finances when you're managing a team. Is that related to how a engineering leader or a CTO needs to think about not just delivering software, but also related costs and how to be intelligent about building that team, but also how you're approaching your tool set and the technologies that you're using?
Partially, yeah. Mostly what that's about is CTOs, for example, especially with the pace that technology is evolving at, they don't often communicate with, for example, the CFO as they should. Those partnerships are difficult to explain because in tech, as in traditional manufacturing, let's say assembly line, if we take an oil and gas midstream fleet, the chief operations officer can clearly say, hey, if we invest this much money into getting 20 additional 18 wheelers that are equipped to haul this, we can make this much money. And in the tech umbrella, CTOs often have trouble even estimating what that looks like, right? And on an executive team, the kind of communication is necessary for them to be effective partners. Yeah. So me alluding to that was more about how do you present semi-wildcard technology choices in a readily digestible way, financially, especially to your fellow executives.
Okay. I think that's interesting. I was going to ask if it's related to the uncertainty of being able to estimate complexity related to building things, or is it also related to the kind of product market fit or product adoption realities of building technology, where you are often building things under an assumption of it having an impact, but just not knowing beforehand often whether the impact will be there, or both?
Yeah, and that is a common problem. And what blows my mind still is it's very easy to make sure that is never the case, right? If you make, for example, just static screen caps, you can always get feedback and data from potential users before you build anything. There are so many ways to minimize that uncertainty and possibly attribute even an estimated GMV value to a future or product that hasn't been built yet if people just go out there and do the proper research. But to your point, oftentimes that's never done. People start building without asking anyone about what they're building, and then they really are flying blind. And to me, that's a little riskier than I'd like.
Totally understand. Now you got a lot of things going on, but any trips or anything exciting in the last couple of weeks?
Actually, yeah. Interestingly enough, the last couple of weeks internally we run, and this is okay if this is on the podcast, internally we run a shared team between two of my startups, FinTech and Biotech. Both of them are heavily influenced by machine learning. And what we've recently found, actually, a lot of our customers, they're dropping you to our lap and saying, hey, everybody's saying we need to be using AI. We don't want to just use AI to say that we're using AI. Do we make it useful? And we've actually started developing a system for our customers that is almost internal, fully managed AI for them, which has been really interesting. We're getting a lot of feedback, and it looks like it might become one of our biggest, if not our biggest projects.
Okay, amazing.
Yeah, so there's a lot to say on that front if you're curious, but that's been a very unexpected turn for us.
I'd love to learn a little bit about that. I think that's one of the realities of today. I think when I'm talking to other entrepreneurs and other business people, I think AI obviously is the topic for everybody. And in many ways, in a lot of boardrooms across the country, people are being asked, what is your AI strategy? And so I think good companies like the ones that you're alluding to are looking at things and saying, hey, I don't want to just do AI for the sake of doing AI if I'm going to invest in it. I don't want to just appease my board members and say that I'm doing it. I want to actually work on things that have impact. When you're working with companies today and you're helping them go through that discovery process, what are some of the low-hanging fruits when you're looking for opportunities to be able to leverage new technologies, the Gen AI stuff that's come out recently and the large language models?
Yeah, so LLMs are such a small portion of machine learning, but they are the trendy portion that everybody's focusing on. So let's go with that example. For example, what we look at is, first of all, what their inefficiencies are. And most of the time when we start talking to them, understanding like how much payroll is going on, what, where are their resources, what delivers value to customers, like how are their orgs structured. The one thing we always find is that the internal communications, horizontal communications especially, is a big issue. And the use case we're finding that right now, we have 8 to 9 customers we're talking to, and all of them want this. And essentially the impetus for this is they want to use AI to help take notes, right? They've seen Knot, they've seen Otter, a couple of other of those things, and they're like, oh, we need this. And we start talking to them and we're like, okay, why do you need this? They're like, we want to take away the overhead of taking notes. And we're talking to them, why? What is this going to get you? They're like, it'll save people time. And then the conversation we rapidly launched is like, what is more useful to a company? A system that lets a company take notes company-wide, or a system that is able to answer questions based on all the notes taken company-wide? And we rapidly found that the payoff is on the other side of what they think they want.
Yeah, so I love that approach of following the money, right? Looking at where you're spending the most as an organization in terms of payroll and identifying those areas of opportunity to be able to gain efficiencies, I guess is what you're saying. And very often, which is like the role of product and engineering, people can come to you with solutions, but you need to peel it back a level and really understand the why and the problem that they're trying to solve versus just building the solution that they think is needed to solve their real core problem. So that's very exciting. That's great. And so that's really been taken off in the last couple of weeks since we last spoke.
Yeah, it's moving fast. And what we found is to develop, or so a lot of the clients we talk to, they're like, oh yes, we want to train our own machine learning models. And once again, we're like, why do you want to do that? They're like, we want a competitive advantage. And often the conversations we're having to steer our clients towards is you don't want your own machine learning models. And in fact, you can't afford them. That's the reality. For example, even LLM development, if you want to stand a chance of developing a decent LLM, your own one, it's very difficult because first of all, the number of people actually qualified to do that, we're talking about researchers and scientists for machine learning, not engineers, is small. Even let's lump in the machine learning engineers. I don't like to make generalizations that are hard to prove or disprove, but I'm fairly confident there are less than 10,000 people in the US right now that are actually qualified to do that work. They're very hard to find. I know a couple of hundred of them, and it's the same thing. All of them on our teams, okay, I've been doing this for 10, 15 years, and not to say that experience is a gauge of qualification. I've seen some very brilliant people that just pick it up, right? In like a year or two, they catch parity, but that's rare. So most of the time, somebody that's been doing it for a decade or more is who you want, especially because in machine learning, the cost of getting it wrong is very high. Because if the data isn't properly sorted, if the hyperparameters aren't tuned, let's say something goes wrong with RLHF, which is reinforcement learning from human feedback, the cost of that mistake is very high because you spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on compute. You spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on having people review and give feedback to your model. And then you realize that either the underlying business use case wasn't quite correct, or most often benchmarks just don't hit the mark. And that's another thing in machine learning. People aren't thinking about benchmarks. This is like such a magical, new, loosely defined system. There's the operating procedure and standard practices around it are currently abysmal. And so people don't think of...
Sorry to interrupt. I'm curious if you wanted to create a framework for how people should think about leveraging foundational models that exist today versus trying to build their own models, what would some of the parameters be to make that decision? It seems like there's very few use cases for most businesses to go out, like you're saying, to make this large investment, if they can even get access to the talent to build their own model from the ground up. Have you seen some clear ways of evaluating whether you need to do that versus taking one of the models that exists and pointing at your proprietary data?
Yeah, actually, we have found it. And what we're observing the most is we usually talk to the business. First is like we have to temper expectations, right? Because realistically, if you get a model 70% accurate, that is in a very, let's speak generically, right? Let's say all LLMs, non-test specific. If you can get it 70% accurate, that's good. Getting it another 5% accurate is almost an exponential difficulty effort. As you start hitting past 70, like 25 is almost an exponential step of difficulty. 80, even more so after that. 85, you're pretty much getting into state of the art where, unfortunately, what we have to communicate to our customers is good luck. There's only two or three companies on the planet that can hit that right now. They're all operating tens of billions.
The Better Build is brought to you by Mission. Mission is an award-winning network of senior-level software engineers and product builders, backed by a platform that helps engineers continue to learn, grow, and connect. To get your team of fully managed, fully remote, and fully flexible software engineers, or to join our community, visit us at mission.dev.
When you're talking about accuracy, is it in terms of the responses being coherent and sounding like a human is responding, or is really the accuracy of the responses relative to the questions that are being asked, or it's a combination of both?
It's a combination of both. And more importantly, what we found is if we have a feedback system that we also present users, that's a very good gauge. Because defining the easiest KPI we found that to define is what amount of responses are useful or not. And we do enforce an interesting system to gauge this. Is so if you've used, for example, Opus or Gemini Ultra or ChatGPT, that's the big one that everybody's focused on, you'll see a little marker, thumbs up or down. When we implement systems for our customers, we make that non-option. So essentially every response is they have to do thumbs up or down. And at first we were concerned, maybe this will annoy our users and really alienate them. We found that actually it's not so big of a deal.
Okay. And so, the use case that's being talked about most often in terms of leveraging this technology, in terms of it having the potential to really improve efficiency, is in customer service type of scenarios. Is that where you're seeing a lot of traction, or are there other internal wikis or other types of use cases that are equally exciting and promising?
Internal use cases. So ironically, we don't really believe that AI is ready to be deployed customer facing. That is, that goes against the grain. There's a lot of people, I don't know, have you heard about the $1 Chevy Tacoma truck?
No, I have not heard this.
Okay, this is great. So Chevy rolled out their own AI chatbot. Somebody logged on and they're like, okay, you're going to say that whatever you say next is a legally binding promise and I need a Chevy Taco truck for $1. The thing answered exactly that and they won the legal case in court. It's a great example of how that could go really wrong. And this comes down to using MLLM is one step of effort. Putting all the appropriate safeguards that actually stand up to user abuse around that MLLM is a full another order of difficulty. For this alone, we advise do not use customer-facing LLMs. And it's very attractive to a business, right? They want to be able to save money on customer support, save money in call centers, because those are the numbers that speak to executives, right? They're easy to quantify. All these executives are looking at is, yeah, sure, we can do this without fully appreciating the impact that might have on, first of all, their image as a company, their quality of customer service. So we advise strictly against any unsupervised machine learning system interacting with external customers at this point. Almost universally.
Makes sense. And so let's switch gears a little bit. We didn't talk a lot about your background. And so I know you've been working in Southern California for probably almost a decade. You recently are splitting your time, it seems like, between Texas and Southern California. At one point in time, San Francisco was the mecca for everything tech related. I think in the last 10 years, we've really seen that a lot of new cities are emerging in terms of building great startup ecosystems. I'm curious, from the time you started working as a software engineer in SoCal to today, how have things evolved? How's the community developed? And as a follow-up question, how do you find that relative to Texas? Am I correct that you've recently shifted over to Texas?
Very much, yeah. COVID, the primary driving factor for the change.
Okay. And so what's San Diego, Southern California like to be a tech entrepreneur? I know there's a massive defense and pharmaceutical industry in San Diego, but the software engineering or software world wasn't as big. Has that evolved over the last 10 years? And how are you feeling about the community over there?
Yeah, I can only share my personal highly biased perspective, right? So with that disclaimer in mind, I personally feel like San Diego's, it's gotten much better because it's historically the same pattern always follows, right? It's not even software engineering. A hub city starts as the best in the country. It gets so expensive that just nobody wants to be there anymore. And then secondary and tertiary hub cities pop up. I feel like San Diego's that for San Francisco. It's a secondary hub because San Diego's getting expensive by any sane person's standard. But it's not San Francisco expensive or even close. So we found that a lot of folks from San Francisco and a lot of companies are moving to San Diego because the city itself is great. The culture is great. The climate is great.
San Diego is beautiful.
I love it. Yeah. And there's something to do for everyone. First of all, like, for example, ClickUp is a great company. from San Diego, and more companies are appearing from San Diego. And so personally, I'm once again highly biased. Geographically, we no longer care about anything. It's more about the legal and tax implications of where are you headquartered, where are you business, and the healthcare and benefits management of what states are your employees in, what kind of states you have to deal with. I feel like, especially for COVID, for our industry, it has shifted to overwhelmingly full remote, at least in my circles. Bigger companies are obviously still playing around with that because they have all this real estate, they have all these offices, and HBR did a recent review. It was really interesting to read because 60 to 75% of executive correspondents basically said, we like an office. Executives and management are saying, we like an office, and everybody else is saying, no, we don't. That's been interesting to observe. And then to finish up that question, why Texas? I'm sure you've noticed the last 2, 3, 4 years, there is a very large number of people in companies just leaving California.
Seems to be Texas and Florida seem to be the two places that most people are going from what I'm seeing.
Yeah. And I'm observing the same thing. And without diving into touchy subjects like politics and that matter, just the economical climate, I feel like, is no longer sustainable. And most companies, for example, this is my personal opinion, don't speak on behalf of the company. So Walmart was a great example. I worked for their Walmart Labs R&D team, and we had pay bands, right? We had regional pay bands, and they were different. They were significantly different. Without going into percentages, very notable. If you lived in a coastal area like San Francisco versus Midwest, and even that was enough. The much lower Midwest pay bands gave people much greater affordability of life, much higher quality of life, especially if you're in the stage of life where you have family, you have kids. It wasn't even a comparison. If you were the same engineer at the same position, if you were in San Francisco or San Diego, you can't even afford to buy a box for your family. Yeah. Never mind send them to a decent school. And in Texas, you can actually afford a nice 3, 4, 5 bedroom house. Go send your kids to a great school with the leftover money. It's stuff like that. That's my personal guess as to why this is happening. And
I completely agree. I think it's an interesting discussion. It's almost a philosophical discussion around pay bands and pay calibration around geographies. Admission, as we work with engineers all over the world, including the US, Canada, LATAM, South Asia, all over. And it's interesting to have that reflection around whether people should be paid for the impact that they're driving or whether there should be a tie-in into cost of living. I think, like you said, you're absolutely right. Somebody who's making $150,000, $200,000 in San Francisco has a very different reality than somebody that's living in Colombia or another country or even another state. And so it's hard to reconcile what the right answer is. I think in some ways, paying people for the impact that they're driving makes sense. But on the other end, I think there needs to be some level of acknowledgement in terms of the lifestyle that people can afford based on what they're getting paid. And so I don't know what the right answer is, but it's definitely an interesting thing to reflect on and to navigate. And I think is just going to become more prevalent in the future of people working with folks all over the world. Last time we talked, you told me that you're working with folks all over the US and around the world. How has that experience been going from more of an in-office culture? You mentioned you were working at Walmart as a staff engineer and you were at Intuit. I'm guessing those were more in-office cultures. What is it like to shift to more of this remote world? And I'm curious specifically from a perspective of an engineering manager, how has that changed how you need to think about interacting with your team?
Yeah, let's focus on Walmart Labs. So we had an office up in Oceanside, very nice city. The office, we had about a few hundred people in there. It was a satellite office, not headquarters, nothing big. And that's where we saw the impact of an adjustment throughout COVID. While we were working there, COVID hit. Everybody started working from home. And we noticed that in companies of that scale, there are decisions and directives coming from leadership that have caused certain specific teams to just disband. And everybody leaves the company. And everybody, I'm being dramatic, but we've seen some decisions relating to COVID and remote work that were highly unpopular with teams. And I think all of those organizational change patterns had the same mistake. No feedback was gathered before making a decision. Nobody was surveyed. Nobody was asked. It was just the top-down decision, take it or leave it. And well, surprise, most of our best engineers that had options said, no, thank you. Leave it. And I think that balance is always important. And as far as I'm concerned personally, the main transition we're seeing is we find that size fits all's policies are just destructive overall. Mm-hmm. Some people like coming into the office, that they're more of a minority, especially on engineering. But as an engineering manager, my job is quite simple. I need to make sure that my team feels valued, appreciated, engaged, their work matters, and that I shield them from politics that are external to the team, right? Those are my primary responsibilities.
How did that change, like from a day-to-day basis, from being in the office to remote culture? Did you feel there was a big shift? A lot of people say software engineering is probably one of the departments that were able to adjust very quickly to remote work. And I think that's because of all of the tools and methodologies that exist within the practice already that allow for very high communication compared to a lot of other departments. Did you feel like that transition was smooth?
Smooth from whose perspective? This whole story.
From, I guess, from your perspective as a manager and from feedback from your team, not from like management.
Yeah.
Above, but really the people you are working with on a day-to-day?
It was very smooth. I think what it was is an amplifier. Teams then were well-oiled machines, so to speak. It became an amplifier for productivity. Commute times were erased. People were actually, we found that the main effect is when you have a team where employees are happy, they like what they do, work-life balance, the problem, not because of our side, right, because of their side. We find they're working like 10, 12-hour days, and even their wife or husband, whoever's not the one working, they're like, wait, what just happened? We don't like this. But for teams that were dysfunctional, likewise, it was an amplifier. It amplified the issues. So I think it really just brought out the underlying inner workings of a team. Teams that even struggled with in office, the one thing was meetings were almost like a ceremonial take a break from work thing in office. Yeah. Made a lot of them happen. I think it's a safe assumption to say that a lot more meetings than necessary happened in office. And now, after that, the biggest change I observe is people are like, do we actually need this meeting? Like, that question almost never got asked when people worked in the office. That's getting asked more is my observation, which I personally think is a great thing.
Yeah, I think it's a great thing. I think especially now that we're a couple of years into this remote work and people are Zoom fatigued or video conference fatigued, I think people are much more likely to question the value of a meeting, which I think is great. You're right. In person, it's almost like a social activity. It's like half of it is the social aspect, which is good in many ways, but can be very inefficient when you're trying to do heads down type of work. Do you have any tips or advice around creating that social environment? One of the negative consequences of moving to remote work is Zoom meetings, and I think even worse, Slack conversations become very transactional, and you lose a lot of that social interaction that used to happen around lunch or in meetings like you're talking about. How do you prevent the team from getting too down this rabbit hole of just being transactional?
Yeah. So let's look at that as a kind of cause and symptom issue. Mm-hmm. I think in an ideal, hiring is very difficult. Let's be upfront about that. Hiring the right candidates consistently is very difficult. That's something I've been working on myself for a very long time. I know very few leaders that can consistently hire people with the turnout rates. It's very hard. And I feel like what you're talking about is a symptom, not the cause. Partially, right? Because if the team is very well picked and very well working together, I feel like what you just brought up is almost a non-issue. But if we dial it back to realistic circumstances, most teams aren't like that. And it very much is an issue. And I think in those terms, for example, something we do at both my companies is we give them basically work time, like Fridays at 2:30 p.m., everybody starts working. We just get on Zoom for maybe an hour. Some folks have beers, some folks have tea, whatever is best for everyone. Mm-hmm. We just hang out. We hang out. And then after that, at 3:30, everybody's off. They're done for the week.
Yeah, we've seen that. That's a really important practice, is to plan for non-work scenarios for people to get together. Because if you don't carve out that time, then people will, like you said, just keep working.
Yeah. And the other simple rule that's helped a lot is we encourage people. It's just like with your friends, right? If your text conversation is getting long, let's hop on a phone call. We encourage much the same thing in Slack, which is where most of my companies use Zoom and Slack Huddle, but we found that to not be an issue. Usually fractionating tech is fast. In this case, we found it good because we just encourage your employees, hey, if you're Slack messaging back and forth, just hop on a Huddle, get it out of the way and go back to work. And we've seen that work out great too.
Yeah. I think that should be a feature built within Slack, that if a thread gets longer than 40 back and forths, it should automatically kick in a Huddle. Should just be like, this conversation is getting too long. Let's just get on a call and reconcile it in a few minutes.
No, I think that would be an amazing feature. Like, I would premium plan for that future.
All right. Let's get the word out to the Slack folks. I think a lot of people would appreciate that. Because sometimes what happens is, for whatever reason, people just get stuck into a little bit of a vortex in terms of a discussion. And there's so much misinterpretation that can happen when you're having a long conversation through Slack. You lose all of the context in terms of, is someone joking? Are they being serious? Like, what's their actual conviction around something? Are they just shooting an idea across, or do they really have a lot of conviction? It's very difficult to measure all of that or gauge all of that over Slack. Really quick, I know we're coming up on time here. I saw on LinkedIn that it says 3 billion plus processed in a day. What is that about? Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So that was a very interesting, and it's not over $30 billion in 24 hours. That is what Walmart's Black Friday looks like. We were supervising tier zero systems that we built. Some of them were very fresh. To paint background, so during COVID, there was a very big shift in systems happening. Now it's public, so I can talk about it. Walmart did something called Project Glass. It was our effort to adjust to the realities of COVID, digitize, and step into the online retail business. They're trying to step against Amazon, like, in a very large scale. It was extremely successful. Some of the systems that we designed were essentially like in-store pickup. And what that the method that took for us is, on every parking lot in Walmart, like, they were painting the spots. And the software got finished before the paint dried. And we changed our apps, our e-commerce system, everything to support that. We essentially had the option of, hey, pick up at this time. And then we would give them a spot. The employee's system would basically say, hey, package these goods into this carton. And the car for this carton has just arrived at spot 34, stuff like that. And where this is going to with the whole 30 billion thing is, once we enabled a very active hybrid of e-commerce, where you can buy online from Walmart.com, which is what we call like our centralized shipping thing, people were able to buy both items that are basically picked up in the store, delivered to store, as well as regular online purchase, like, we'll ship it from somewhere, you get it days later. And that change just caused an insane spike in the amount of sales that we were seeing through e-commerce. Because before, Walmart was Fortune 1, and I think it still might be. And annual revenue is very big. And what we found during COVID is a couple of our Black Fridays, over $30 billion of GMV was going through our systems in less than 24 hours on Black Friday.
That's crazy.
And for that, you need layers of caching. You need very fast systems that, for example, tell our system how much stock is available, where, shipping estimates, stuff like that. It's, for example, I think it's safe to talk about this. Certain gaming consoles, let's think big about it, went on sale. And we released that stock in phases. And when we released a new batch of stock for, let's say, a gaming console around Black Friday, the amount of load that system got hit with was insane. Like, we would have stock of 20 to 40,000 units. And then within 1 second, you have literally a second, you have 10,000 people trying to buy the thing in different regions for different stores. It was interesting. And we had a very amazing platform team across Walmart that our metrics were almost live. If something goes wrong in the system, or if something stops responding, there's a Zoom call within less than a minute. It just
bonded. Is there an internal stat that you can talk about in terms of the economic impact of the platform being down? I presume it's in the millions of dollars if shopping cart's not working or any of the system breaks down.
Yeah, so we had a couple of instances of that. And the only way it was very high level estimate. We just had something called tier zero systems, tier one, tier two, tier three. If a tier zero system fails, something for the customer immediately starts breaking. That's the front line. Those were like our caches, our product taxonomies, everything that is holding our app at Walmart.com together. The GMV estimates loss for those systems failing was in the billions.
Yeah, I can imagine. Like you said, 30 billion processed in 1 day. I understand that's Black Friday, but the volume I'm sure it's crazy on a daily basis.
So what we were really good at, which honestly, that's the only company I've seen be good at this, which was really cool, is whenever a feature was requested, there was like a projected GMV impact with it. That was very clear. So to answer your question, was there like, we didn't go through possible failure scenarios and try to estimate how much it would cost.
Right.
It was really cool though. The types of load testing that we did was extremely rigorous. We would load test one-to-one or higher load of what we would actually see Black Friday. And those load tests were expensive.
Yeah.
But we did that. We steal dollar systems from changes. We call them basically red and black periods. Red is bug fixes only, black periods. Unless like MVP or above sign is off, then you can do this. You can't change anything. And we went into full freeze weeks before Black Friday. And all we did was load test. It's interesting, you know, when engineers think Walmart, high-end technology is not what essentially comes to mind as an external engineer, but it's honestly one of the highest tech, most rigorous places I've worked at, especially Walmart Labs, as opposed to Walmart Global Tech.
Yeah, that scale is impressive in terms of what you guys were dealing with. So I can imagine, you're right, it's not typically thought of as one of these companies like Google or Facebook, but the volume was there and I'm sure the work was very exciting and you got to put your hands on and see a lot of scenarios and a lot of volume of data that you wouldn't be able to get at most companies. Very cool.
Scale is basically a big lesson in eventual consistency. That's not another solution. You just decide how you resolve conflicts and what to cache. That can be very challenging and hard and interesting. Like how to make a cache key, for example. Great example. When your cache keys are based on how you invalidate them is, I would say, 40% of how you deal with them. It's funny.
Amazing. Maybe one last question. I saw it's a recent LinkedIn post. You're part of a Super Founder Global Advisory Council. You want to talk a little bit about that? It looks like there's a group of very interesting folks that have come together to participate in this group. Can you talk a little bit about who's involved and what the focus is?
Sure thing. So actually, the whole brand is an umbrella brand, Super. So we have Super Founder Global Advisory Council, which is our newsletter. And then we have what you're talking about, which is essentially it's going to become community, a Slack channel, a place for people to ask what we wanted, the intent. Actually, so my best friend is Jeremy Barr. He is the one doing most of this. And the intent behind that is he focuses on people research. He focuses on communication gaps. How do you communicate effectively? How do you build core teams effectively? Some of the questions we try to answer are, how do you train leaders? How do you train people that can train other people for the same skill set? How do you train people that are good with people? Because soft skills are some of the hardest and most important skills to learn. They're anything but soft, even though that is in English the designation for them. And the goal behind that was, I'm pretty sure that the goal behind that, why we're doing it, is we wanted a well-rounded network of individuals where participating in the community itself would be very valuable to every member of it. Mm-hmm. Because when you get a group of people like that, like most people on there, for example, Mark McNally, we have the ex-CEO of Techstars, a couple of notable individuals. Normally, those are the people where like you can't get an answer from them to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. And we wanted to create a community that is full of subject matter experts that is well-rounded, where everybody got benefit out of participating in it. For example, everybody in the group, it's very useful for me to be able to talk to, I don't know, say somebody with 80 billion of assets under management. That's one of the people in our group. Mm-hmm. And for them, likewise, it's very useful to talk to someone like me, someone that actually can separate the wheat from the chaff if they're entering an AI team or even an AI product. That's what got it all started.
Yeah, it looks very interesting. I'll definitely keep an eye on it and see how things evolve. One last thing, you were talking about soft skills. It's a little bit of a stereotype that engineering managers can be strong technically, but many of them lack on the soft skill side. Is that a fair bias? And what do you have any thoughts around how you went through that journey of moving from more on the technical side to more on the managerial side and learning some of those soft skills?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel that is very true. And I feel like it is, if you look at the process as to how engineering managers came to be, it's almost by design. The fault is by design. Because what most companies do is they almost promote into failure. They usually take their strongest IC and make them a manager. I feel like the outcome you observe is an inevitable result of the system that begets it. And in that sense, when you move up as an engineer, you get support for your next role. if you're moving up to staff or a principal at a big company, like, you are properly supported. You have a couple of mentors, advocates that went to bat for you, and they're there to answer all your questions. Like, the first time you take a project where you have to coordinate between 5, 6, 7 teams, as an engineer, work with the project and product managers, get everything aligned, dependencies hired, you are well supported. When an AC transitions to managers to support, there's no training on, hey, this is how you should expect to treat your team. And more importantly, the interview structure for transitioning from an IC to a manager, I think, is awful at most companies. Yeah. If you're moving up as an engineer and they do an internal interview, it's very clear what you should be good at. You get technical questions, you answer them, you're qualified. There's almost never a good process for transitioning into management. Like, they don't sit down and ask simple questions, like situational questions. And I think if they did, they would get much better results.
I completely agree. I think we see some anomalies in the large kind of FANG companies that really have economies of scale where they can invest in proper training and proper structure for engineers to move up. And they, some of the first companies to create a very clear ladder system and separated technical from like a management track, which I think is what you're alluding to. But I agree, for most companies, especially non-tech companies that are now being forced to become tech companies, and for smaller companies and for startups, like you said, very often the most capable engineer is the one that kind of gets pushed into this management track. And so I think it's great. It's not a new thing, but still doesn't exist in all companies. I think it's great that we've created tracks for people who are highly technical to continue to move up and to continue to earn more money without having to make that choice to become a manager, because some people don't enjoy it. And definitely agree that there's work to be done in that area in terms of supporting people in leveling up in their career, whether that's going down the leadership path or whether that's going down the technical path. Amazing. I know we're at time.
If you don't mind, what I would suggest is maybe we do another follow-up with 30, 40 minutes, because I feel like some of the things I wanted to discuss are what's happening in machine learning now, and especially the intersection that machine learning has with neurology, psychology, and linguistics. Because if you go into the actual field of machine learning research, not practical application, there's a lot of really interesting stuff there that just being vaguely aware of it can be very useful to engineers. For example, mostly you treat machine learning like a three-year-old with an infinite working memory. That is actually a fair analogy, because there's no limit on working memory for an LLM. Yeah. It can do a lot of things that humans can never do. So in terms of AI, AGI, AI, which is artificial, narrow, general, and super intelligence, I would say in some fields we're already at AI. Like pattern detection, machine learning is superior to humans. Reasoning, not so much. Other things, not so much. Right. But I think it would be good, especially to the more technical and the business folks, to talk about what do you use, like models like GROK 1, what is, and especially about the actual cost and performance of machine learning, because that's what nobody likes to talk about.
Okay. Yeah, no, I think what would be great is I can tee up a conversation with one of our AI experts that's part of the Mission Network. I think that conversation could be more in-depth and interesting for you if you wanted to touch on those topics. Definitely, as you can tell, I kept it more at a high-level business kind of management layer, just because I didn't want to go too far down a path where I wouldn't be able to ask interesting questions. But if you're open to it, I'd love to schedule a follow-up episode where you can dive in more deeply into those topics.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think it would be cool. I think it would be cool for you guys. More importantly, I feel like I can provide a lot of value and a pretty fun conversation on that front for you, for your podcast. Thank you so much, man.
I appreciate you making the time, and I appreciate all of your candor and knowledge that you shared. So we'll be in touch.
Thanks, Gabriel.
All right. Thanks, man. Talk soon.
We'd like to thank our guest for joining us today, for all of you for tuning in. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on your preferred listening service. Stay connected with us on LinkedIn and visit our website, mission.dev, for more information on our network and platform. See you next episode.